today we're going to talk about climate change. And the theme of today's discussion is states, cities, and even corporations taking the lead on climate change. So just a little bit of, I'll just kind of give a short intro and then I'll introduce you to our panelists. The context here is basically that since President Trump announced that he would pull out of the Paris climate deal last year, we've kind of seen this coalition of mayors, states, cities, corporate executives from across the globe spring up and take it upon themselves to continue action on climate. They've vowed to take whatever actions they can to cut the U.S. Greenhouse gas emissions at least 26% below 2005 levels by 2025, as outlined in the agreement. They've made a lot of announcements about renewable energy, electric vehicles, fossil fuel divestment, things like that. And many of them have kind of adopted this mantle, we're still in. You know, the federal government may not be acting, but we're still in. But the stark reality is that few nations are anywhere close to meeting the emissions reductions that are needed to reach the targets in the Paris Pact. And even meeting those targets would only get us about one-third of the way we need to actually keeping global warming within the 2-degree target that scientists recommend. This gap in emissions is alarming, according to the UN, and it's clear that President Trump's policies reversing course on climate change are putting what was already a difficult goal even further out of reach. So there's been a lot of analyses of this, and we really, there's really this very significant emissions gap. So what we're here to talk about today is what can the U.S. and even other countries do to make up for this this disconnect, this gap, and what can they do? What recourse do states, cities, and other, you know, subnational or non-federal actors, what can they do to live up to the U.S. pledge, you know, pledges made on climate, and what other steps can they take to reduce emissions and hold polluters accountable? Are we hopelessly set back by this step, or are there perhaps new, more creative ways to get at the emissions puzzle here? So let me just start here with Jessica Beland, who joins us from the Kresge Foundation. There she works in the Environment Program, seeking to help cities build their resilience in the face of climate change. And she works on climate change mitigation, preparedness, and social equity, working on grant making and other activities related to energy efficiency and buildings and other operations. Prior to joining Kresge in 2008, Jessica served as managing editor for Environmental Building News and editor of Green Source Magazine, so also a writer in her history too. And to her right here is Judith Enck, and she is senior advisor for the Center for Climate Integrity. And prior to that, served from 2009 to 2017 as a regional administrator for U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Region 2, which includes New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, right?
And eight Indian nations in New York.
Yes, eight Indian nations. She's also a professor at Bennington College, where she's currently teaching classes on plastics pollution. And then to her right, Andy Revkin. Andy is a strategic advisor for environmental and science journalism at the National Geographic Society. And he has the distinction of being in his 30th year of reporting on climate change, which I think few of us, I don't know if any of us can really say we've been doing it that long.
Here it is. Yeah. So long ago, there were cigarette ads in the back of Science magazine.
It's connected.
Yeah, pretty wild. October of 88, so October, nice. Literally this month.
Wow. Yeah, so you may know Andy's work from his years of reporting at the New York Times, both as a staff reporter and also through his Dot Earth blog. He's also worked at ProPublica and is this spring, just earlier this year, joined the National Geographic Society. So with that, I'll open it up to Jessica to start. We're going to have just some opening remarks from each of the panelists. And why don't you take it away?
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
So there was a piece in Wired magazine last month where Matt Simon's not here, is he? I don't know what he looks like.
problem with journalists. Well, he described writing about climate as an exercise in managed insanity, which sort of resonated with me, and I'm guessing probably with many of you in the room as well. So I, too, have been working on climate for a long time, not as long as Andy, but for a long time. And let me just say that I'm not usually asked to be the one to bring the good news into the conversation. But the very dark story of climate change does have some brighter subplots, and city action right now is one of them, one of the brightest subplots. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, so thank you for giving me a chance to talk about happy news for a change. And thanks to each of my fellow panelists. I have such deep admiration for the work that each of you does. It's a real honor to be here with you. So again, my name is Jessica Bieland. I work at the Kresge Foundation, which is a $3.8 billion private philanthropy based just down the road in Troy, Michigan. And we do a lot of work here in Michigan and especially in Detroit. But we also work nationally to expand opportunities in America's cities, as you may have heard on NPR. I work on Kresge's environment program, which Tony got right, works to help cities reduce carbon emissions and prepare for climate change in ways that enhance the influence and the benefit for low-income communities and communities of color. So I want to share quickly four pieces of news that I find encouraging, and I hope you do as well. First, cities are finding their voices on climate change, largely in response to Trump's intention to pull out of Paris. We're up to 280 cities and counties that have declared that they are still in and intend to continue to work toward their Paris commitments, toward our Paris commitments. And 86 cities at last count have committed to achieving 100% renewable energy. No small feat. Of course, those are bold statements, and they're just bold statements unless action follows. But I think that those statements are a prerequisite to action, which brings me to my second point, which is that cities are thankfully taking action as well. Not only on their own municipal operations, but citywide across their transportation and energy supply and building energy use and waste and other energy using systems. So some of you probably are familiar with C40, which is a global network of mega cities committed to addressing climate change. They recently announced that 27 of their members had peaked their carbon emissions. They define peak as having come down and stayed down for at least 5 years. So they peaked at least 5 years ago, and they've reduced their carbon emissions by at least 10%. So they're on their way, and there are dozens of other cities that are right on their heels. The third bit of good news that I want to share is that cities are using climate action to deliver a range of benefits beyond just carbon reduction, which we know, for starters, doesn't resonate very well with much of the public. But clean energy does, as does economic growth, as do jobs, as does public health, as does justice. So on the economic growth piece, those 27 cities that C40 reported have peaked their emissions, they've also grown their economies at the same time by an average of 3% per year. Just a couple of examples of what that means in the U.S. Since 2005, New York City has reduced emissions by 15% while growing its economy by 19%. San Francisco has reduced carbon emissions since 1990 by 28%. While growing its economy 78%. Those are some particularly positive examples, but there are a lot of other examples. If anyone's interested in more, I've got a list of them down here. So thankfully, climate action delivers other benefits beyond economic development as well. Atlanta's mayor, Keisha Lance Bottom, said recently that, quote, climate action is not only about protecting our environment and our economy, it is about justice and quality of life. Atlanta's 100% clean energy pledge is a social contract to protect the health and the welfare of our residents. So my fourth bit of good news, and I think the most encouraging one, is that cities are starting, especially the last couple of years, to collaborate, to do more faster together. So a few examples of that. Through the Climate Mayors Network, 30 cities are using their collective buying power to electrify their vehicle fleets, so that's not just cars, but actually buses and semis and garbage trucks and everything else that they own and operate. Through the City Energy Project, 20 cities are working together to improve energy efficiency in existing buildings, public and private. through the Building Electrification Initiative, a new effort. 8 cities and more coming soon are working with one another and with heat pump manufacturers to electrify buildings' heating and hot water systems.
This is your story.
A group called the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, which is an alliance of 200 communities across the U.S. and Canada, just this week actually came out with a set of 14 strategies that they have deemed have outsized climate impact and a commitment to help one another, the membership of USDN, make progress on those strategies. They're here if you're interested, and online if you're interested in learning more about them. And finally, the Carbon Neutral Cities Alliance, CNCA, which is a network of 20 cities with the world's most ambitious climate commitments, are collaborating on what they have called game changers, a set of strategies that they see as really the leading edge of climate decarbonization. They put out a great report. It's online. Recommend checking it out. And if you're interested in more of this kind of story, talk to me, talk to you on our communications team. I also want to recommend this book, which is actually not quite yet hot off the presses. It comes out officially in December, called Life After Carbon, which tells the story of how cities are getting off carbon and preparing for the effects of climate change and what that means for the future of cities, what those actions are doing to transform what it means to be a city. So check that out. So there's a lot of good news to report, but I don't want to diminish the enormity of the challenge that we all face, that cities face, in dealing with climate change. This is very difficult, very complicated, very long-term, and very expensive work. And even if they're successful, even in the best-case scenario where they meet the commitments that they've made, where all those 84 cities hit their 100% renewable energy targets and everything else, we know that that's still pretty wildly insufficient to the challenge. We do need federal leadership. We do need international cooperation. But this so-called subnational effort action at the city, state, corporate, nonprofit levels is necessary. Even if the Trump administration were leading on climate, we would still need all this action at the subnational level. And it's adding up. It's significant. So data-driven Yale reported last month that commitments from cities, states, and corporations will get the U.S. at least halfway to our Paris commitments. And a similar study from the Rocky Mountain Institute found that those commitments will get us 2/3 of the way. So the truth is somewhere in there and fairly positive. So we know that climate action at the city level matters, sort of in the hard number crunching of climate. And we know that it also matters instead of the softer calculus of experimentation and influence. Cities can test and tinker with policies and programs. They can normalize action, and they can inspire people, not only their residents, which matters a great deal, but also observers in other parts of the country and the world, other levels of government, and other sectors of the economy. So for a long, long time, those of us working on climate have complained that, I'm sure you've all heard this, we have everything we need except political will. So in some mayor's offices, in many mayor's offices, we have it now, which is really exciting. And we also have evidence that city action is possible, that they can do more than make commitments. They have more than just the political will, that city action and carbon reduction can coexist with economic growth, and that it can drive a range of other benefits for their communities. And most important, I think we have the beginnings of an infrastructure to help city action move from individual success stories to a collective force that's really making a difference. So we know that city action will never be the full answer to climate change, but it is a part of the answer, and I think that matters a great deal, especially in these times. So that's what I wanted to say, and really look forward to the conversation.
Great, thank you. And thanks to Tony for pulling us all together. I'm Judith Enk with the Center for Climate Integrity. And I want to talk about who pays for the damage caused by climate change. We know the 4 warmest years on record have all occurred since 2014. And communities across the globe are paying a lot of money to deal with sea level rise, really hot temperatures, and all the collateral damage associated with climate change. Local governments are paying to do things like elevate roads. I worked on Hurricane Sandy when I was at EPA, one of the most harrowing experiences was learning that one of our biggest sewage treatment plants had lost power and backup power. So we had literally billions of gallons of raw sewage going into Newark Bay for days. After Hurricane Sandy, that water authority decided to move a lot of their essential equipment out of the basement and to a higher floor in their operation. That cost a lot of money that ratepayers paid to do that. Recently in the Northeast, we were used to snow days. We had heat days where schools were closed, where local governments opened up cooling centers for seniors. All of that costs money. And the question is, who pays? I really noticed a great quote by Eric Holthaus, a writer and meteorologist with GRIST. I think it appeared just last week. Eric wrote, "We have entered the heart of climate change's period of consequences. This is not cause for despair or remorse. It is a time for courageous action." So the way I've internalized that direction is to work on climate litigation, which is in its very, very early stages. I am not a lawyer, but I work for an organization that encourages local governments and state governments to sue the oil and gas and coal industry for the damage that their product has caused to the world. Think tobacco litigation. And I love Andy Revkin's article, "The Greenhouse Effect, This Summer Was Merely a Warm-Up." And that was written in 1988. We know that the oil and gas and coal industry knew about the dangers of climate change for decades. In fact, Exxon has some of the smartest scientists and engineers who predicted with precision what we are experiencing today. We're not going to see federal action for a long time, regardless of who is president and who is in Congress. I am afraid, because of the grip that the oil and gas and coal industry has on federal decision making. At the same time, we know the industry is in hot water. There's lawsuits filed by ExxonMobil shareholders. There's a move across the country that I'm not working on but observing, which is divestment from fossil fuels. And we now have a number of lawsuits that have been filed by governments. So these are essentially, for those of you who work on Superfund issues, this is essentially a cost recovery lawsuit. A state has costs related to climate change. Who pays? Taxpayers or the fossil fuel industry that has contributed to climate change? And no one is expecting the fossil fuel industry to pay for everything, but simply to pay their fair share. So there are lawsuits filed in Colorado, the city of Boulder, Boulder County, and San Miguel County. Sued ExxonMobil and Suncor for climate impacts that made wildfires worse, contributed to droughts, floods, and other impact. All of the legal filings you can find on payupclimatepolluters.org. Also, Columbia University, Michael Berger and Michael Gerard, professors there, have actually the best, better than ours, the best website that lists all the complaints and all the legal documents. So you can look at the legal filings from Colorado. The earliest cases were filed in California, Richmond, California, Santa Cruz, San Francisco and Oakland, Imperial Beach and San Mateo and Marin counties. Baltimore, Maryland, in July of this year, sued 26 oil and gas companies. The city of New York has sued. The first state, the state of Rhode Island, has sued. Makes sense, it's a coastal community. And then in Washington state, King County sued 5 oil and gas companies. And what's going on in the courts is the fossil fuel industry tries to get these lawsuits moved almost immediately to federal court, where they think they have a more sympathetic bench. And I think by the end of the day today, they'll have an even more sympathetic bench when these cases get to the Supreme Court. So there's a real preference for these cases to be filed in state court. The San Francisco, Oakland, and New York City cases that have filed in federal court have already been dismissed. They are on appeal. And one thing that's very interesting from these lawsuits is seeing documents that are shared if they're made public. One of the federal judges, Judge Aslop in the Ninth Circuit, actually did a four-hour climate tutorial a few months ago, and that was very, very interesting. So I think these lawsuits are very important, and they have caught the attention of the fossil fuel industry. There is a new organization called the Climate Leadership Council, led by former Secretary of State James Baker. And that group has kind of morphed into another group, and they've hired the lobbyists, Senators Trent Lott of Mississippi and John Breaux of Louisiana, longtime lobbyists and two of Big Oil's most devoted public servants. I never thought of Trent Lott and John Breaux as climate champions, but they are now, and they are advancing the idea of a carbon tax in Congress, along with a liability waiver that would ensure that the fossil fuel industry never has to answer for these lawsuits. Legislation has not yet been introduced, but Trent Lott and John Breaux now work for Hill & Knowlton, a lobbying firm. I'm sorry, they work for Squire Patton Boggs, a lobbying firm, and then they've hired the PR firm Hill & Knowlton. And this is all laid out with great detail in an article in Vox by David Roberts. I love the headline. Energy lobbyists have a new pact to push a carbon tax. Wait, what? And this appeared June 23rd. This, for national reporters, this issue of the liability waiver is something to really pay attention to, because it would knock out all of these lawsuits. No one is looking to bankrupt the oil and gas and coal industry. We are looking to get them to pay their fair share. Low-income communities particularly struggle with the impacts of climate change. We know that climate change doesn't cause hurricanes, but it makes them stronger. So from my work on Hurricane Sandy, my recent work in the U.S. Virgin Islands after Hurricane Maria, I've seen firsthand particularly what happens to poorer communities after disasters like hurricanes hit, or you have intense rainfall and people have raw sewage in their basements. This is very much an environmental justice issue. It's also very much a societal issue and a cultural issue. When I was in the U.S. Virgin Islands, I spoke to some men who, after the hurricanes hit, remember it was two Category 5 hurricanes that hit within a month. And, you know, I was working on how the solid waste response and how do you get the electrical grid back up and how do you lift all the boats that were sunk in the Caribbean out. But the conversations that really stuck with me is with some men who said they sent their wives and children to Atlanta or New York or Florida, and they weren't going to see them for a year. And I remember saying, well, you know, because this was in the fall, I said, well, certainly you'll see them over the holidays. No, we had to borrow money to send our families off so they're not in this mess with no electricity and not a functioning sewage system. And we're going to see more and more of this in the future. So I think it's important when you report on climate change, the science is pivotal. The policy debates are important. But also the real life stories of what climate change does in communities, I think, is just as important. I think I'll end there. So there are two. There's Pay Up Polluters and then Columbia University Law School Google Michael
Sabin Center.
Thank you. Climate Change Tracker is the Sabin Center. And they have all the legal actions worldwide, not just these cost recovery lawsuits. And you can get all the legal papers, and they're brilliant. I'll leave it at that.
Great. I was going to say Andy Revkin, but you know that already. So I joined National Geographic after 30 years of this journey of mine on climate change, because it's the first place I've found, the only place I've found right now that's a sustainable source of grants and money and support for sustainability-focused journalism. That's why I'm there. And there needs to be some innovation. And it's not just innovation in, like, how you tell a story, apps and social media and video and infographics, which National Geographic has famously been amazing at, but it's apps and how you to my mind, it's apps and new apps for how do you approach a story like this? I made a big mistake. I mean, you can't call it a mistake if you don't really know it's a mistake at the time. You know, it wasn't like, I was consciously, when I was writing about climate change and cities and sea level and wildfire risk and everything else that was in this 6,000 word story in 1988, I was coming at it with a lens that was honed during the 70s and 80s when I was coming of age as a young person and thinking about journalism around, this is a pollution problem. And it took me like 20 years to realize, oh my God, this is so much bigger than a pollution problem. It's a fundamental, you know, our need for energy is so underpins our progress as we define it in the 21st century that we're in surge mode. And urbanization is a fundamental process. In the 1970s, when I was in college, after I got out of college, I went to these small islands in the Pacific, and all the kids were moving to the cities, even in 1978, to Papeete in the middle. They were in Polynesia and paradise. You know, and these small islands were losing all their young people because they're going to the city even then, and now even more so. So cities, this urbanization surge is happening even as we're modifying the climate system, and the impacts of the urbanization surge on vulnerability to things like coastal flooding is by far the dominant factor driving losses in all these storms we're writing about. Puerto Rico's losses were about decades of underinvestment in basic infrastructure and all the shameful neglect of Puerto Rico as a part of the United States and all of that stuff. And then so a storm hits in the middle of context of climate change, which is sort of like our filter, our lens for many of us as environmental journalists. And if it's hard to step back and say, well, what really happened? What really drove it? And then it's hard to sort of tell that story. It's not a clean narrative to say that the losses in Puerto Rico or the losses in Haiyan and in Tacloban in the Philippines were a function of demographic change far more than anything going on with typhoons. And that's a harder story to tell. It's a harder story to sell to your editor. As I was just talking with someone here from NPR, that once we get locked in on a narrative, and so in the middle of all this stuff that's going on and fast forward on our planet, what do you do? How do you cover that? How do you think in a new way? And to me, it gets back to some of the most basic things that journalists are supposed to do, which is something big happened, and so you ask those basic questions. What just happened? What do I know about the drivers of change? And then on the solution side, what do I know about what would have made it better? And obviously in an earthquake or a hurricane, you don't get to the solution story instantly. But as you think about the architecture of these challenges, it's important to try to take away the filters that everyone is buffeting you with. Jerry Brown, when he talks about, look online to see if Jerry Brown ever mentioned zoning in a speech on wildfire. He jumps right to, it's the new normal, climate change. And that says nothing about how Californians have spent 50 years building incredible vulnerability, planting palm trees that are imported from Canary Islands. Look for just Google for Revkin palm tree fire, and you'll find, it blows my mind. There are places in Southern California that burned down in Beverly Hills, like 20 years ago, rebuilt the same mansions, planted the same palm trees. Palm trees are basically giant sparklers. They're oil. They're like this big oil towers. And just go on YouTube and look for a burning palm tree, and you'll see what I'm saying. So the story, the vulnerability there, climate change is in this mix of things that are going on in a region like California. But if you're, as a reporter, if you have that preconception, I call it narrative capture. Actually, there's a hashtag on narrative capture on Twitter. It's important for us to like take away our own blinders and our newsroom blinders and make sure when someone says something, and these are all things we all know as journalists. You're mostly journalists, right? It's like, you know, we all don't want to be stenographers, right? And then, so when you do that, then lots of opportunities emerge to tell these stories of urban risk and response in an age of changing climate and changing us, meaning the humans. You know, we're urbanizing. We have these deep divergences between poor and rich, not just globally, but in the same city. There's a great photo essay by a guy who had one photo in Nat Geo, Johnny Miller. He's doing this aerial drone photography called Unequal Spaces. Like, look at that. And you see this, you know, slum right next to golf course. And he's done this in South Africa and all around the world. And that's a great way to tell aspects of this story, you know, with journalism tools that are available now that aren't just about melting glaciers and all that stuff, and that talk about things that you can actually actionably work on that communities are not working on that could dramatically reduce vulnerability in a political cycle or even, you know, in a few years. And then you mentioned the importance of science. My God, you know, I came at this through the science side, and sometimes we've had this habit of walling off science that is inconvenient. And Al Gore talked about the inconvenient truths. There are many inconvenient truths that Al Gore did not include in his film. And there's one right there. I put a shortcut up on the board. j.mp/climate-inertia. I was at MIT with some of the smartest climate people around in the world, and I interviewed these two guys who've been at it for 35 years, longer than me. Two climate wonks, and I said, the single aspect of global warming science that even people who are worried about it don't get? I said, what's the thing that we don't get? And they both said right away, inertia. That, you know, even if we had a perfect energy policy, even if Al Gore and Mike Bloomberg ran the world starting tomorrow and turned off every, you know, air conditioner and car engine and power plant, the climate system will not notice that for decades, and then even then it would be incremental. So there's nothing about our energy choices right now that will make a big, noticeable difference in climate outcomes, meaning impacts. And that's really actionable, and it tells you a lot about how to frame stories and how to think about what people are telling you and how to sort of chart a reality-based path forward on writing about urbanization, vulnerability, climate change. And there's more to say, but maybe we'll stop there.
All right, well,
can I just make just one quick follow-up on this point that I forgot? If you haven't covered hurricanes, climate impacts, you will. I mean, when I went to work for EPA, I didn't know I would be an expert on hurricane response, but that happened. And I think along some of the points that Andy made in terms of just kind of common sense things, FEMA policy is a real problem after storms. They can only rebuild what existed prior to the storm, the flood, whatever it is. So I remember battling FEMA and Army Corps of Engineers when they wanted to rebuild a sewage treatment plant on Long Island after Hurricane Sandy that never met the requirements of the Clean Water Act. So they're going to rebuild it the same way. And then most importantly in the Caribbean, billions of our tax dollars were used to put up the same old rickety fossil fuel electricity system that will come down during the next storm. No investment in microgrids. In the last budget allocation in Congress, after tons of work, some of us were able to get the word resiliency into the budget appropriation. But, you know, so many people died in Puerto Rico because of lack of electricity for a long period of time. That will happen again after the next storm. So that is worth a close look.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to bring it bring it back to the city and local level here, and I think a couple people mentioned the idea of how do you deal with climate change at a time of urbanization and where a lot of the action and the emissions are occurring in cities. And so what I wanted to ask some of the panelists to address is, with the people you work with, or even when you're covering stories like this, where do you see as the most effective arenas for emissions reduction and for adapting to climate change? Where's, so to speak, like where's the biggest bang for a buck? If knowing that there's all these limitations, where is the focus best? You know, best. Where is it best that we focus our efforts?
Well, I'll just kick it off, but would love to hear what others say as well. It's a hard question to answer in large part because it's so context dependent on both the mitigation and the adaptation side. You know, sea level rise matters if you live near the sea, and heat matters in different places, and the risks vary based on where you're at, and not just in the city, not just where you're at in the country, but where you're at in which neighborhood and what kind of resources you have at your disposal. On the mitigation side, and I want to say, Andy, I absolutely agree, and thank you for pointing out the lag and the long inertia in these systems. What we do on the energy front won't matter much in the next decade or two, but it has existential consequences for what we do decades out, and we won't get the chance to come back and redo it, you know, if we realize we missed the boat. I think it depends a lot on, you know, your energy mix, how if it's a hydro system or a coal-based system, and different energy markets, et cetera. But we know a few things. In almost every city, existing buildings are the biggest source of carbon emissions. In some cities, it's transit or transportation. But in most cities, it is buildings. And so we need to figure out a way to get into the existing buildings and make them much more energy efficient. So we need to get everything as efficient as we can. We need to electrify as much as we can. And then we need to green the grid. So, you know, those are sort of the three ingredients that most cities are focused on, and the most effective and cost-effective ways of getting at that mix will vary.
I think in New York City, one of the most important climate strategies is the subway system, which is in rapid decline. And part of it is because of lack of investment by the state of New York. A lot of people in the city don't realize the state actually runs the New York City transit system. And also there's some recent data on Uber and Lyft, and people, because they feel like the subways are not reliable, you're late for a meeting, your subway has stopped running. This happened to me recently. You race upstairs and you get in an Uber. And there's now data on how that is affecting air quality. And then because this is a very sophisticated crowd, you won't get lost on this. As we shift toward electrification, the fossil fuel industry is now really ramping up on single-use plastic manufacturing, particularly these increase in ethylene cracker plants all over the country. Over 250 of them are proposed to be built or expanded in Texas, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, the Ohio Valley. The fossil fuel industry is not going to say, oh, you know, we're losing customers. They're going to look at their new customer base, and it's petrochemical production.
Yeah, those background trends are really important. I'll bring up something Michael Bloomberg did his last year in office as mayor. There's two elements that get at this. Part of the Bloomberg administration did these big studies. I think it was NYC 2030 or something like that. And one of their findings, which was really jarring to me as a journalist, was that at that time, 2013, it said about 75% of emissions in New York are from cities. From buildings, right? And so you want to cut emissions, but it said 80% of the buildings that will exist in 2050 in New York City already exist. And there's like 400,000 buildings. Maybe it's hundreds of thousands of buildings. It's something. It is a million. I was afraid to actually state the number because it's so big. So what does that say? That says the grunt work of retrofitting is a huge challenge. This is for older existing cities like our cities, Detroit, New York City. It's a retrofit thing. It's not like some shiny new magic city is coming. And that's really hard. The other thing was, this came up in this earlier session. Alex Kaufman mentioned that Kate Aronoff is writing a book about the new climate denial, which is sort of progressive liberal climate denial. And one thing that didn't come up was, again, in his farewell speech about climate change, Bloomberg, who's now a UN envoy and everything, he said about New York City related to sea level rise. It was a big speech laying out a $20 billion commitment to make New York City more resilient, more energy efficient. He said, as New Yorkers, we cannot and will not abandon our waterfront. It's one of our greatest assets. We must protect it, not retreat from it. And I wrote about this as absolute climate denial. This is climate science denial. Sea levels are rising for centuries to come. We don't know how fast. It's still as uncertain as it was in 1988, because ice sheets are really hard. But to say we will not retreat, as opposed to, you know, we need to design a New York City that's more resilient and can take a flood like the one in 1820. There was a hurricane in 1820, something that made Manhattan into two islands. So that can take a hit and come back and have subways that work. So when I give lectures to students about this, like communication students, they said, so pretend you're the press secretary for the new mayor of New York, and she reads some new climate report, and she really understands that sea level is going to rise no matter what we do with emissions. And she says, write me a speech that says we will retreat. We will retreat. What does that sound like? What's that speech look like? How do you build a frontier community, engineering, entrepreneurial culture around how do you make a city work with no new normal sea level? That's the challenge on the sea level side of our time. Jeff Goodell's book starts to get at this. So those two things, grunt work, it's not all about the magic thing. And they have I think there's a retrofit accelerator program in New York City right now, but they're trying to figure out how you do that. And there are big moments. By the way, education plays a role in this too. I went to a school in New York City that has a fantastic curriculum element. They do a boiler room tour where the kids go down and the custodian for the day is the teacher. And he says, this is how much oil we use. And 20 years ago, we burned coal in this school. Most New York City schools, I'm sure Detroit too, burned coal to keep warm. And so then the kids are learning that a school is a system, not just classrooms. And that, if you're not getting that kind of systems understanding, we're not going to make much progress in this either. And all of those are stories. That's all story there. But it's not like the story we've been telling.
So Andy talked about earlier on about kind of this climate inertia in the physical, in the climate system. Is there also an inertia or an inflexibility in the built environment that needs to be confronted? And maybe, Jessica, you could talk about some of the things that are on the menu for cities that actually want to start shifting that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think keeping it in the building space for the moment. So New York is probably farther ahead than any other city in the U.S. right now in really understanding how buildings are using energy and what to do about it. In part because they were the first city in the country to pass a benchmarking law. Forgive me for the wonkiness here, but basically just means that owners of buildings have to measure their energy use and make it public every year so that it can help to correct the market failure. That efficiency isn't invisible, right? So if you can look at the 10 buildings you're thinking of buying or leasing space in and see how much energy they use, you can factor that into your decision. They've been doing that for a number of years now. A number of other cities have followed behind. So there are 20 cities or something in the U.S. that are now implementing benchmarking programs. And it helps them understand where the opportunities are. So that I wish I had the statistic in front of me, but it's something like of those million buildings, 80% of the energy use is in the top 5%, the biggest 5% of them. I mean, there are huge opportunities if you know where to start.
Which is so important. Doing the grunt work of right. The baseline, where the change can happen quickest. Yeah.
Right. And then that also opens up opportunities to work with the utility, who can then target their efficiency programs much more effectively. And they can help to build a market around building retrofit that can sustain itself over time because new information is coming into the market all the time. Justifying additional investments in energy efficiency. So that's not a full answer, but yes, there's huge inertia in the real estate market, in the energy market, and in every piece of this puzzle, figuring out the chinks where we can sort of break apart those systems and change the inertia is sort of the secret here, I think.
Yeah.
And I just got to say, the woman who in New York City who created the school that has that element in its curriculum, her last name is Ornektikin. She's out of government now, but she this is the jobs component. The city got a big federal grant to do some retrofitting, some kind of new boilers for all those city buildings, you know, the giant housing complex in New York City, but they require more sophisticated computer knowledge. And she went to the union in New York City, and they said, we don't have people who can do that. So that's why she created this high school for energy and technology. It's one of those New York City-focused high schools. There's like an aviation high school. So she actually worked to create the school to generate the employability to run the new systems in a retrofitted city. And that's systems thinking, you know, it's that required her to like cross four different department barriers. And those stories are really undertold.
Well, let's move up a little bit to the state and regional level, because right now you kind of have this really interesting dynamic where, you know, California is doing a lot and coming into conflict with the Trump administration on a lot of these exact issues. And I was kind of going to ask you to do like a thought experiment here. And I know journalists don't like to speak in hypotheticals, but let's like, you know, rewind 2 years back and imagine that the outcome of the 2016 election was different and we were dealing with a Hillary Clinton administration. How many of these things, what would you be working on now, and how many of these things are things that you would be doing anyway, and what are kind of the key emission reduction strategies that we're missing out on that really cannot be done because of the federal government? So I'll kind of ask you to take that one, Judith.
You're trying to make me cry.
God.
You know, the easy stuff, we would be implementing the Clean Power Plan, which was the first legal requirement to reduce carbon emissions at fossil fuel plants. Just fossil fuel plants, you know, just that part of the economy. We'd be working a lot on waste issues. Waste is a climate change issue in the beginning and in the end. In the beginning, reducing the proliferation of single-use plastic packaging, and then in the end, dealing with methane emissions from existing landfills, dealing with carbon from garbage incinerators and biomass plants. I think you'd see a whole lot more resources to states and local governments to innovate. I think we would have been working really hard to implement the requirements of the Paris Climate Accord. I personally think, you know, there's a long list of environmental policy mistakes out of the Trump administration. I think the issue that'll have the most long-lasting impact is pulling out of Paris. And, you know, we're the only nation that's not part of the Paris Climate Accord. I could go on and on, but I'll end it there.
And what are some of the, I'm just
piggy. Can I? Yeah, go ahead. I did it when I was at ProPublica that brief year. I did a piece on Trump the day the week of the Paris Agreement statement. We're not out of it yet, by the way.
Right.
In fact, it would take until 2020 for us to.
But we're not working to implement.
No. The worst thing, what I wrote then was the biggest thing he did was stopping the money going to the pots of money that are commitments under Paris and the underlying framework convention, because that is what will kill the whole treaty. It's not the emissions commitments. The good thing about Paris was it's a 100-year plan to move the world toward a safe climate. And that was the first time in all the time I've been covering that process that it was reality-based. But it's the commitments of money for developing countries that no one has lived up to, and us now even less, that's going to kill the treaty, because they will walk out. The whole thing will unravel based on the money commitments. And that was the single thing he did. And it's far more relevant to climate than anything he's done with policy, actually. I did. The U.S. is 17% of the global pie of emissions is U.S. now, 17%. So this marginal change, a Clinton-Trump change, is not determinative at all. But what he did with that process is pretty damaging.
If I could just jump in quickly, too. I think, ironically, you know, action at the city level is dramatically stronger than it would have been under a Clinton presidency. because there's been this need at the local level to push back, to stand up, to carry on momentum, and I think it's been, and at the state level to some extent as well. And another piece that I think has been really valuable, sort of under-recognized, is the increasing sort of solidarity across movements. So the climate movement and the justice movement in particular are finding common cause and finding new ways to work together, largely because they're feeling oppressed in similar ways by the current administration, right? And so there is this new energy, this new momentum that I think has enormous potential to help change some of the momentum that you were referring to earlier, Tony, and really move us forward.
Right, and where, you know, with some of these, with the federal inaction right now, I was hoping maybe there could be some discussion of how the state level, you know, California, but also northeastern states, some of the, not only the emissions regulations they have, but these, like as you say, these emerging collaborations, how effective are they going to be in terms of making up for the progress we're losing out on with the Trump administration? What's the sense on that?
I think the question is, you know, where are we going to be at the federal level in a couple of years, right? I mean, I think that this momentum is enormously helpful, and if that can lead into a to national leadership with the next administration, we could be okay. That might not happen.
I mean, but are we in a position where we have kind of this red state, blue state dichotomy, and the blue states are banding together and trying to counteract, but is it enough, you know? Is it enough to get us to where we need to go?
It's not enough, and I don't think it's red state, blue state. I mean, no. The leading generators of electricity from wind are Iowa, Texas.
Right.
You know, they far exceed New York State. New York State only gets 4% of its electricity from solar and wind. I think there's some remarkable work being done at the state and local level. I don't think it's going to be enough. And also, there's not enough money. You know, when I talk to students about climate change, the first thing, you don't want to totally depress them, so you don't start like I did today with the hottest years on record, etc. I start with, okay, here are some major sources of carbon pollution: the transportation sector, the electricity sector. What are alternatives to fossil fuels? And we come up with lists and lists and lists of cleaner alternatives. So we know what the solutions are. What we don't have is the political leadership or the money. This is going to cost a lot of money. This is not cheap. But I think, you know, I really applaud the innovative work being done. States are laboratories, but it's not nearly enough to deal with catastrophic impacts of climate
change.
Now,
outside of just bringing it back to the climate liability mm-hmm. movement, and I mean, where do we get the money? I know that California's cap and trade system is generating billions of dollars, and that's being used for projects, but are there any, outside of suing the industry or raising a ton of government funds, where does it come from?
Well, you know, when I left EPA, I had to decide where can I be the most effective on climate change issues, and I decided not lobbying Congress or the state legislature. And I signed up with Center for Climate Integrity because I think litigation is going to have the most long-term impact. And it was kind of funny. You look at every great social movement, litigation was a key part of it, but not really on climate change. And so I think it's either the taxpayer pays or the producers pay. And the oil and gas industry is not happy with these lawsuits. They are limited. There will be more. But I think that's the long-term strategy, to pay for all the shifts that need to happen.
I don't think this is about money. I think we have the capacity, for sure. This is not about politics either. I mentioned this yesterday in a response to after one of the panels. There's unbelievable capacity for innovation, both on policy, which can lead to innovations in Washington, but also on using technology for sustainability. The examples that come to mind, and this relates to foundations and where they invest their money, including National Geographic's now bounty through its endowment. Volkswagen's incredible scandal. This is not climate-related as much as mortality emissions. The great scandal, their diesel, their hacked diesel systems, didn't come from the New York Times or ProPublica or The Economist, or it came from a tiny laboratory in West Virginia, West Virginia University, with this $100,000 grant from a little tiny nonprofit. And all they did was they tested the emissions for the car, and they weren't looking for this. They actually had a different task, but it was like a $15 billion judgment came out of this tiny lab's ground truthing on what these cars actually emit. And that says, how many campuses are there in this country where, unfortunately, students' tracks are still toward getting your tenure, getting your impact paper on some energy question. And that's all good. We need that, too. But if you could tweak it to be like impact science, meaning not just accountability science as opposed to like accountability journalism like we did at ProPublica, it's all out there. It's just the incentives aren't there. There was a $15 billion judgment against VW, and that little lab is still struggling for money. That means something's really wrong and can be really right. And there are all these methane EDF is launching its own satellite, Environmental Defense Fund. You know, we can impose transparency on the world in ways that were impossible even 10 years ago. Big push at National Geographic. The human impacts map is the thing we're putting online now. So it's not about money. It's about intentionality and what do you do with your capacity and how can we harness it.
I actually want to, we only have 15 minutes left, so I want to open it up to questions, if that's all right. So we're going to start with just our procedures here, SCJ members and journalists first, and just identify yourself and your affiliation when you ask.
And. Yeah. You don't just stop. You start right here.
I'm Cassidy Umeda. I'm a student at the University of Missouri, more commonly known as ZU. So how important is solution-based journalism in this process?
So the question is, how important is solutions-based journalism to this process?
It's huge, but it's a change, you know. We don't historically we didn't do that. But there's a Solutions Journalism Network. I'm going to their meeting in November. Everything we're doing with our new structure at National Geographic isn't just about telling a better story, like taking a better picture. We can do that for the rest of eternity, as Geographic has done and won every prize, 80 million people on Instagram. But what do you do with that is the challenge of our time. And that's all about outcome. And it doesn't have to be advocacy. It's like, you know, when I wrote Dot Earth for 10 years at the Times, it moved to the opinion side of the paper, but it was my opinion is reality matters. And my opinion is what's working and not working. And just pointing that out is solutions journalism.
In the back.
John Sutter from CNN. And I spent a lot of the last year in Puerto Rico reporting mostly on like the uncounted deaths associated with that storm. And my question is about how to, so there's a certain like logic in responding to disasters in the way that we report on that, things that have happened, people that did die because they didn't have electricity. I'm wondering what tips you all have in terms of data sources, storytelling techniques, like pitching stories in terms of like thinking about preventing those deaths from occurring in the future. Because I mean, I very much would like to make that turn with that story, but it's a harder sell in some ways. It's not theoretical. We know these things are going to keep happening, but just in terms of the strategies around making those stories like interesting for our audiences, because they're so important, but I think they often go untold because it's not something that has happened already.
So the question is about almost like preventative journalism, where you're rather than just writing about a disaster like a hurricane, how do you report about, and any tips for how do you cover things from a preventative mindset and in advance?
I would really focus on the electricity sector, because if you lose electricity, you know, your hospitals can't function, you can't process drinking water, sewage treatment plants don't work. And so was the electricity system resilient before the storm, after we spent a massive amount of federal tax dollars, will it be resilient enough for the next storm? And in the case of Puerto Rico, the electricity system was a mess prior to the storm. There's one government-run monopoly called PREPA, which was not particularly well run. When I was at EPA, we sued them many times for violation of the Clean Air Act. But even if you had a really well run public or private utility, that storm would have taken down all of the above ground power lines, and you don't have decentralized power. So I think the electricity, everything clicks from the electricity issue. So I would look at that closely and look at your community. Are you ready for your Hurricane Maria or your tornado or your flood?
And are there data sources on storm, like vulnerability of those systems? You know, are there anything that comes to mind?
Well, I would meet with your local utility and see the, you know, it's not just are they old, but are they resilient? Everything cascades from the electrical system.
By the way, the value there, you know, I think the world would have been better off if we had an intergovernmental panel on vulnerability reduction than an intergovernmental panel on climate change, because these are all multifactorial risks. If it had been an earthquake or a tsunami, Puerto Rico, the whole Caribbean is vulnerable to tsunami risk. Haiti is going to have another earthquake. That one was not a one-time thing. So resilience and vulnerability in cities and rural areas is a story all the time, and it's multi-factor. So, and electricity, absolutely. And during Sandy, one thing I wrote about after Sandy was someone at Pace University, they're experts in distributed energy. How do you build a grid that can have that capacity? One of the inconvenient facts for climate is quite often having natural gas allows you to have local generation of power, like they had at Co-op City, where the lights did not go out, but it's a fossil fuel in that case. You know, and renewables will be the solution somewhere else, but the resilience can actually require sometimes thinking more about fossil fuels too. So
I would just add, so we have used stories probably by you and others in this room about the vulnerability and failures of the grid in Puerto Rico and elsewhere to make the case for grant and program-related investments to support the installation of solar and battery storage systems in low-income communities in American cities. And I think the more that we can get stories of vulnerability and solutions into places where that same kind of risk is present in advance of that risk hitting, you know, the better off we'll be. So I think, you know, thinking about your local context, your local vulnerabilities, and then look for other parts of the world that have been through that kind of risk. What happened on the bad side? What happened to prevent it from being worse, and you know, try to get those stories into the local conversation.
My name is Julie Hoffman. I'm a freelance journalist. So Judith, I wanted to ask you about the legal strategy, which I think is interesting. Given the incredible resources of the oil and gas companies, it seems like I would imagine you obviously want to, you know, have a case. You want to, you know, have some good legal precedent. Is there any particular case that you're looking at now? It doesn't sound like you've had a win yet, but is there any that you think has got great potential, and is there any other case you can talk to me about in the past where, you know, it was a real sort of David and Goliath situation where they were successful that you were to as well?
So yeah. The question is about the legal cases against the oil and gas industry, and are there past cases or current cases that that are, you know, in the works?
You know, I would look toward the tobacco litigation. That is what this is modeled on. And it's interesting, the tobacco companies tried to get a liability waiver through Congress and failed. I'd also look at the MTBE litigation. The MTBE manufacturers tried to get a liability waiver through Congress and failed. The one industry that did get the liability waiver through Congress was the gun industry. So, you know, I have a list of cases. I honestly don't know which has the best shot. A lot depends on what judge you are in front of. And I think we're going to see more and more of these cases because local governments don't have the money to deal with either climate impacts that have already hit. I can tell you all over New York and New Jersey, post Sandy, even though the federal government provided $60 billion, there are still Sandy issues going on. And then if, you know, look at the work of 100 Resilient Cities out of Manhattan, they embed resiliency coordinators in local governments all over the world. But what you quickly find when you do a comprehensive resiliency plan is there's not enough money to cover the costs.
Over here.
My name is Sabrina Shankman. I'm a reporter inside Climate News. And I can kind of piggyback off your question a little bit. But I'm curious, with the state and city lawsuits as compared with, like, the Our Children's Trust lawsuits, you know, if you see any key differences or potential for success one way or the other.
Yeah, so I think all of these lawsuits are critically important. Our Children's Trust is saying that kids have a constitutional right to a clean and healthy environment, and it's the Giuliana case, and they're suing, it's like over 25 kids when they started, and now they're young adults, some of them. They're suing the federal government for lack of adequate response to the climate crisis. The liability lawsuits are more, you know, plain vanilla cost recovery lawsuits. You know, there's a long history in tort law. If you come to my backyard and dump a bucket of benzene and my cow dies, I can really go after you for that damage. And that's what these lawsuits are about. What we're seeing in some of the legal filings from the fossil fuel industry is it's not their fault. It's all of our fault because we use their products. We drove our cars. We heated our homes. And that argument worked in the New York City lawsuit that was recently dismissed. It's very similar to tobacco. You blame the smoker, not the company that produced the dangerous product that the manufacturer knew was dangerous for decades. So I think it's going to take a couple tries, but I think these lawsuits are the single most important litigation strategy to potentially get resources to communities that are already impacted by climate or want to do some smart resiliency investments.
I'll say I'm a deep skeptic on that. I think all the ferment around using laws to be part of the solutions on climate change is really important. But the thing that's different between tobacco and fossil fuels is another way to frame that argument, to take the other point of view, is that tobacco has no upside, except maybe to farmers. And fossil fuels have had an unbelievable upside. All of the cities that exist were built benefiting from the energy that we all did harvest. So it's not the tobacco impacts are a negative, period, except for the monetary. The guy at the corner store getting a few cents selling a pack of cigarettes. So it's fundamentally different in that sense. And the other thing is we also need to sue all the developers and city governments who neglected to limit coastal development in the last 40 years. That are the biggest source of losses that we are seeing on the planet in poor and rich places is from where and how we're building and where governments have lapsed in expanding opportunities for poor people coming into cities in the Philippines or in our cities, just having ridiculous subsidies that are fostering dangerous development that we pay for. 2006, I did a big story on climate scientists who came together. They were fighting about global warming's role in hurricanes. 10 scientists, a real fight about climate change in hurricanes. And they wrote this thing. The main hurricane problem facing the United States is the lemming-like march to the sea. These demographic trends are setting us up for rapidly increasing human and economic losses from hurricane disasters. And these were scientists who were Judy Curry and Kerry Emanuel, you know, deeply divergent on hurricanes and global warming, came together because, and who's responsible for that? It's not the oil companies. So, let's be fully.
There are many, many people responsible for the crisis we're facing, but I'm much more, I think I'm. Totally agree, you know, and our federal flood insurance programs pay people to keep rebuilding on barrier islands and things like that. There's plenty of blame to go around, and what our work is focused on is having the fossil fuel industry paying its fair share. Not everything, but you can't just let these generators of fossil fuels completely off the hook, which is what we have now.
Yeah, I agree.
Carolyn Wetzel. The importance of these companies having permits to emit figure into this liability?
Yeah, so companies often use permit shields and say the government gave me a permit. They weren't permitted to emit carbon, though. They did have permits to emit mercury and lead and sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. They were not permitted to emit carbon. But that argument will come if it hasn't already.
Here.
Thank you.
This one down
most here. Of the discussion that we've heard this morning is focusing on cities. There hasn't been that much on states, and I'm curious if you have any more information or details about things that happen at the state level. And if so, is it happening through laws, through regulatory changes? What's going on there, aside from California?
Richards.
So I spend almost all my time focused on cities. I know far less than I should and wish I did about states, but I think...
Well, Northeast, we have the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which was established by a Republican governor, George Pataki, implemented by Democratic governors that I worked for, but the idea was a Republican governor. And that's all of the Northeast. New Jersey is now rejoining after Governor Christie pulled New Jersey out. And that is a big revenue source for clean energy projects. It's not like cap and dividend. The money from cap and trade is plowed into energy efficiency. So all these buildings we need to retrofit in New York City, that's a funding source in renewable energy.
And it, you know, I think it's 17 of the states that were fighting the clean power plan in court. There's 27 states, right, that were... have locked the clean power plan up in court. 17 of them were already on track to meet. 17 of the opponents of the clean power plan were already on track to meet its 2020 and commitments because of actions at the state level. There was Carbon County, Wyoming, that was planning the biggest wind farm in America, and I'm not sure what the status of that is right now. It was actually to supply electricity to Los Angeles.
You also have just a whole raft of, in terms of legislation, you have a whole raft of laws in California aimed at renewable energy. I mean, some of them are splashier than others, and, you know, Governor Jerry Brown just recently issued even an executive order about achieving, with a goal of achieving carbon neutrality across the entire California economy. So there's some splashier stuff like that, but there's also more lesser known
Hawaii
also. There's also some lesser known rulemaking type initiatives, things like California's cap and trade program, but also the low carbon fuel standard, which kind of nudges a lot of the transportation sector toward cleaner fuels.
If I can make two quick points, just kind of trends worth paying attention to, I think. One is that the state preemption threat, which, you know, especially where there are blue cities and red states, this is still very much in development, where states are putting the kibosh on city action. Another thing I think on the more positive side from a climate perspective is the notion that cities are starting to collaborate to be in dialogue with state legislatures about state-level policy that's more supportive to their agendas.
Okay, I think we have time for maybe one, two more. Was there someone down in the front that I'm not seeing? Okay.
It's kind of the same question.
Okay, then up here, yeah.
Hi, Clint Wilder, a senior editor with Clean Edge. This is for Jessica. Mm-hmm. You talked about places where the economy's grown and emissions have dropped. What are some good sources of data that show the direct link from clean energy economy, companies, and economic activity contributing to the economic growth?
Let me follow up with you on that. I know Carbon Neutral Cities Alliance will have some of that, and C40 will have some of that, but there's a better answer that I'll need to do a little research on, get back to you.
Okay, well, I want to thank all our panelists, and let's give them a round of applause, and thank you very much.